What's up, y'all? Tommy and I, we do this thing every once in a while. It might be more often. I'm not going to make any promises, but here we are nonetheless. Tommy, good. Always good to talk to you. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Nice to be back. Nice to chat with you. It is intermittent, but it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, you've been now you're CrossFit famous. You've been traveling the world. So this is perfect. Because we're gonna. I want to open this thing up with like just a little bit of vulnerability, because I think we always ask like, okay, people never talk about changing their mind. And that's kind of what I want to do in this podcast, is talk about how, like, I always think about like, okay, what's the evidence that I would need to see to change my bias or to change my viewpoint? Mm-hmm. And I first started going gluten-free 15 years ago, which sounds crazy. Yeah. And it was a massive shift in my diet. I went from like very carb heavy, like 21 years old, carbs and whey protein shakes, like Kashi cereal, way too much Kashi cereal. So like a ton of insoluble fiber. And then I transitioned to like gluten-free. And obviously I think that was like monumental for me as a person. Cause I had a ton of GI issues throughout my childhood. And they were gone. And so, to me, gluten was the thing. I didn't even know what a FODMAP was at that point, but I had a reduction in symptomatology. And so I was gluten-free for almost like, I think 5 years. If I was trying to track the data back before this, before I even knew what transglutaminase was, before I even knew like what the testing was. And so at that point, and I think there's a lot of people in that bucket of where I am currently, of like, you've eliminated gluten, and in that process, and to kind of like zoom in, what we're talking about here is this intersection between gluten, FODMAPs, which are fermentable carbohydrate sources, and then gastrointestinal symptomatology. And it's hard to really untangle this. And I think we've just had a few really good randomized controlled trials. One of them, a triple crossover, double blinded, like banana land study design here, with 110 participants, like out of Sweden, which was, I mean, we're talking about like study, tough, really, really tough study designs. This is up there. And I can't even run the stats on this thing. We're talking, and that's why Tommy's here, like some type of generalized linear modeling. What these new studies are trying to do is they're trying to bifurcate and figure out, is it the fructose, is it the FODMAPs, fructans, or all these fancy words, or is it this gluten, which is a protein in predominantly in wheat, rye, and barley? The first study that I think we're going to talk about is Norden, which is that triple crossover design where every subject is essentially running the placebo. So how this was set up, I'll share my screen for those who are watching. And this is an open access paper. You can see it. It's out of Uppsala, which so if you've watched a lot of Norse TV shows, this is, I like seeing that city. Just throw that out there. But this was wild. And so these two studies that we're going to compare here are kind of opposite. One is a challenge study, and the other one is essentially a FODMAP reduction diet with gluten or without. We're going to talk about this one first. It's a double blind placebo controlled randomized three-way study with a triple crossover design. I've never seen that before. Have you seen that before?
No, I mean, like, this is pretty intense. And with like a washout period in between each of them, which you like would expect. But I mean, amazing that they managed to get this done and funded. This is great.
And they only had 7 dropouts.
Yeah.
And 110 participants, like a lot of the folks are in the strength and conditioning world right now. Like, this is, as far as like sample number, and like, imagine, like, this is wild. And then the primary outcome for both of these studies was a questionnaire, which I found interesting that, I mean, they didn't have like calprotectin or a lot of like, maybe that'll come, like kind of the gut inflammation markers.
I think one of the things they said, and you're right, I mean, calprotectin is interesting. You know, we may talk about circulating zonulin, that's interesting, but they basically said there's no established biomarkers for disease. Like the gold standard is a questionnaire. So I think that's why they used it. But you're right. It would have been interesting to have some kind of biomarker, something that they would have tracked just to kind of see if there was any signal there.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point, in that this IBS SSS questionnaire, it seems to be like a scale of 1 to 100. And that's kind of one of the, I like the critiques of this paper, is that even in the FODMAP group, which saw the, so if we explain the study design a little bit, so they have, there's a couple of things that we can kind of warp speed this thing. They went on a low impact diet throughout, and it's already pretty telling that their IBS, their scores were better on study. I think that's one of the reasons that they were able to keep people in the study, is that their digestive symptomatology was better on study than at baseline. And so then they had this low impact diet, and then they introduced FODMAPs, and then they introduced gluten, and they introduced a placebo. And that's kind of your study design here, which you can kind of see. And that was randomized to how they went through that. And then there was a washout in between each one. And so the main finding here, I think the biggest finding here is in, I'll just go to the table. So the total IBSS score went up by 42 compared to placebo when these individuals were on the FODMAP diet compared to the placebo diet. That's pretty much the main finding.
Low FODMAP diet, or like,
yeah. Good clarification there. Did I hit that? Like, the main finding here is this 240 versus 198. Is that correct?
And then also the 240 versus 208. So there was significantly greater score it wasn't low FODMAP. This is when they're eating FODMAPs, right? They're eating FODMAPs compared to when they're eating a placebo. So that's mm-hmm. without FODMAPs or gluten, right? Their score goes up by 42 on average. But then also went up by 32 on average when they were eating the FODMAPs compared to when they were eating gluten, right? So then it's the FODMAPs that turned out to be more of an issue than the gluten, and they isolated that effect.
And so how this one hits the internet is that it's FODMAPs, not gluten, non-celiac gluten sensitivity doesn't exist. You guys are stupid. It's only the FODMAPs. That's kind of how it hits the internet. Like, that's the abstract PubMed Ninja taking that to Instagram. And I think that leaves a lot to be desired, because you clearly didn't read the paper, because in their conclusion statement, they're like, there was so much individual variability here that you can't really take that away. You can't take that statement away. Now on average. And so that's, I think, where we can go to the next study. Unfortunately, we don't have individual data here, which would have been really, really interesting. Because my guess is that, and they hint at this in the discussion, is that you didn't see any, you saw a lot of individual variability in how people responded. And that's kind of the main outcome here, is this average finding. And that was primarily driven by abdominal distension and severity of abdominal pain for the FODMAP group. But what I found most interesting, Tommy, and I don't know if you found this interesting in a study, was that it actually wasn't that bad. That's what I found. I thought that, given all of the data that you have showing people reducing FODMAPs, I thought that people eating 50% more FODMAPs than the general population in a rice porridge, I thought that this would be significantly worse, to be honest. Like, I thought I thought if you would have asked me pre-intervention, like, what I thought would have happened on that FODMAP group, I don't know how I would have bet on the gluten group, but I would have bet pretty heavy on the FODMAP group that they would have seen some pretty harsh, like, symptomatology. And in this double blind placebo control trial, it was arguable whether this was even clinically significant or not.
Yeah, there's an important, like, a couple of important points there. One, like, they said that the proportion of people whose symptoms went up by like a score of 50 out of 500, or a score of by more than 100 out of 500, the proportion of those was like the same across the different diets, right? So, like, no difference in terms of these big jumps. They said that a score of 50 change is what you need for it to be clinically significant. I've seen other papers that say 15%, and percent also kind of makes more sense to me, because like a jump from 450 to 500 is very different from a jump from like 250 to 300, you know, like in terms of relative terms. So if you thought about it as like a 15% as being significant, then they are seeing a significant increase in the FODMAP group. So it kind of depends on how you classify it. But you're right, like severe, you know, more severe symptoms, I think the cutoff is around 300. Nobody, you know, on average, they didn't end up there. You know, maybe some people did. But you're right, as a group, their disease or their symptoms didn't get like really significantly worse on average, which is interesting considering, you know, we're thinking that the FODMAPs are maybe a significant contributor to that.
And I really implore people to read the exclusion inclusion criteria on this study, because it's going to be really hard to find somebody to make it in here. Like their exclusion criteria are massive. And so
you basically had to have IBS, but be exceptionally healthy in every other way.
Which is yeah. pretty hard to do. Yeah. We knocked this study a little bit for not having individual data. And I think that given what they say in the discussion, I think that would be really, really cool to see. But I think it's the big points for this one on me were like, okay, FODMAPs did seem to do it. Gluten didn't seem to do it in this situation, but that was on a mean, that was on a group mean. I want to see the individual data. And then here you highlighted that, what we see here in figure three with this dichotomization of point differences. But the biggest finding for me that really, I don't think was articulated enough was just the overall kind of null finding here, dropping an immense amount of gluten and FODMAPs on people with IBS didn't change quality of life. Yeah. Didn't change like stool frequency, didn't change a lot of like, I would have definitely guessed there would have been if you would have asked me to be, I'd be like, yeah, a lot of people are going to shit their pants. I'm like dropping in 50% more FODMAPs than the average person eats. I'd be like, dude, I think most people would probably have symptomatology there. But so I thought that was really, really interesting. Anything to add on that, Tommy?
Yeah, just that. Well, just to briefly go back, so I'm looking at table one again, like baseline, baseline characteristics, like the mean IBS SSS score at baseline, if you go down to the bottom there, was over 300 in every randomization sequence group on average. And so by the time they went down to baseline and added FODMAPs or gluten back, right, all of them, regardless of which intervention group they're in and regardless when, on average had much lower scores. Right. So then
that's a good point. I mean, that really highlights how like the washout period, these people probably felt better on trial, regardless of what they were eating.
Yeah. 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 And dramatic. So like the effect of going from like the baseline diet, whatever it was, to the diet, like which excludes a bunch of other stuff, but has a bunch of FODMAPs in, that effect was bigger than adding the FODMAPs to the diet that had no diet or no gluten or FODMAPs in it, then they just add FODMAPs. So like there's something else that these people are eating or being exposed to, or maybe it's just like the Hawthorne effect, like somehow improves.
Yeah, they talk about that in the discussion, is like all of a sudden like they're getting this individualized care. Maybe that was the I guess the placebo there. Yeah. Super interesting.
Yeah. So like there's some important signal here, but like there's a lot of other stuff going on, right? It can't just be the FODMAPs. Even if they've showed that is probably a bit of it.
I think we have to highlight. So one of the things that I don't know if they did this in the second trial, but this is my, like, we've talked about this a ton on air and off air, like the worry about worry. And so the second study that we're going to talk about is obviously very like pro reducing FODMAP. Like, and you can see the spin is there. What they cite is there. It's very evident that they are okay. Low FODMAP diets are going to be very, very impactful. And so we've talked about this in courses, is like, I kind of, what I think about in my head is like, okay, can we do all of the, if it is FODMAPs? And so now we're getting into like how I would potentially talk about this and what I would do with someone who thinks they have a problem with gluten or FODMAPs. and most people know those words now, I think. Maybe in the general population, maybe I'm off on that. Maybe people don't really know FODMAPs yet, but people know gluten. And so what I struggle with is like, okay, what's the placebo, nocebo here? It's probably, there's been research on this. It's probably no different than other placebo nocebos. But I'm in my head, I'm always, okay, can we leave the narrative alone? And can we just do food swaps? Like, can we just take, and let's transition to the second paper, because I think the second paper is really, anything to add on this, Tommy, before we transition out?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Main findings.
There's like a weird statistical thing that I found strange, but they admitted to it and it probably doesn't make any difference and nobody will care about that. Other than that, we've talked about everything.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the stats on this one far and away harder than the stats on the second one's very, like, not the same people in the same, very standardized. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The main finding in this one is like they did better on diet than baseline, and then FODMAPs seem to pop them up a little bit. I think that's our main finding, but then a bunch of other null findings that I found equally as important, which I think is like, if I had to summarize, it'd be like the effect of being in a research study overwhelmed the effect of gluten and FODMAPs.
Something that's happening throughout the entire protocol, the baseline diet they've been recommended or whatever, like something there is definitely making a bigger effect than the FODMAPs or gluten individually.
Which is interesting. We don't know what that was. That wasn't the study designed to figure that out, but it was interesting nonetheless. And so let's pop over to this. So that first paper was in AJCN. Obviously, this is a well-known high impact factor journal in nutrition. I didn't know what clinical nutrition e-spent. I didn't know what that was, but its impact factor is up there with AJCN. So I think that that's something I looked up. Like I thought this, like, okay, this could be like a backyard journal somewhere, like, because there are a lot of predatory nutrition journals out there.
Yeah.
And I'm always thinking about that in the back of my head. So it's something that I check. And so this study design, a lot more clear. Taking a group of people, both of these groups are going on a low FODMAP diet. And so let's go look at the on diet. Cause I think that's, we'll talk about baseline statistics, but let's look at like on diet, like what these folks were eating. So I think the thing that jumped out to me is like, look at how low the fiber is. It's self-reported, but look how low the fiber is on both diets. We're talking
12 grams,
sub 15 grams of total fiber in the day. I mean, you could argue like, this is probably not good to leave people here long-term. I think maybe you can make that argument. It's tenuous, but obviously underreporting probably to a significant degree here. Yeah. As people always do, not like protein, interesting. That's very low. A lot, but probably more carbs than most people would think at around 200 for, and more than 200 in the placebo group. But I want to preface, because as we talk about this, I want to preface this as like, this is, I don't know if this is a reduction in FODMAP from their baseline or a reduction in fiber from their baseline. I'm sure it was a reduction in FODMAPs, but this is a very low fiber diet, period. Anything to add on that?
No, you're right. It doesn't, they don't give us any baseline values. So we don't know how these things changed compared to the study period. And actually, when I was looking at, when I saw, this is table three, where it's got like all the like macros and some, right, fructose oligosaccharides, galactoligosaccharides, fructans, FODMAPs, fructose, lactose, being caffeine, being calculated from the diet. And I was like, where did they collect this data from? And it just, there's like one sentence which says menus of subjects were documented and the quantities of macro and micronutrients were assessed using the Nutrition 4 software. Like,
I don't know, it's some kind of self-report, right? And so to give people context, this study is out of Iran, which you will see, nothing against, this is where it comes from. You also see some kind of weird stuff, like language wise. Also, I don't understand, like, I don't know how much caffeine this is. This, like, 15.5 cups of coffee. Like, what is this? 15.
That's a good point. I mean,
that can't be milligrams. Can't be
milligrams.
I don't know what that value
unless,
is.
Unless, like, everybody had one cup of green tea or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it was super low.
Yeah.
There's some odd things in this, just this overall like dissemination of like they change intervention group versus control group and like placebo group. I don't know how that made it through review, but neither here nor there. And so this to me, I think this is the most interesting. So if we, again, not many people, there's probably something that we should talk about beforehand, which is the difference in baseline criteria.
They failed to randomize these people properly. Like in the group, right? So the groups eat, they both go on a low FODMAP diet, right? Both groups, but one group has extra added gluten, right? So that's that. In they don't get gluten, they get a fully low FODMAP diet without gluten. They have much worse IBS and like all their symptom scores are worse.
Argue this was set up to benefit. Like the control is much, they have much more severe IBS.
Yeah. And so those are the right. So it's going to be impossible to fully isolate the effects here because I mean, these are different groups of people, right? In the group that got gluten, a quarter had mild IBS, whereas none of the people in the control group had mild IBS. Like this, the randomization, however they did it, which they don't say, has failed here because you've created two very different groups of people before you even do the intervention.
Yeah, I would have seen this and I would have been like, okay, we don't want to do a randomized control trial. We almost want to do like a strength conditioning part where you it's a controlled trial where you assess it pre- like, okay, we want to have the same, severity here. Same number.
Yeah, you do some kind of matching during randomization. Like,
yeah,
you randomize by severity of IBS. So then you always ensure that the same proportion of people, same proportion of severities end up in each group. Like you can do that. Mm-hmm. But I'd just be really surprised if this happened by, I don't know, by random. It like, that's quite a big difference.
Well, I don't know why that would. I'm not. I think it's, we're not inferring malintent here.
No, of course not. No, that's not what I mean. But
I think what we're saying is like this is absolutely set up for the control group to probably have better results because they have some. They have more. That would be my hypothesis is because they have more severe IBS. So you ultimately have more room to go down. Do you think I'm barking up the right tree there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think anybody did this on purpose, but for whatever reason, it's sort of skewed what you're going to see.
This is very odd for baseline characteristics to have this many significant things different. Very odd.
The group that get low FODMAP, no gluten, they have further to go down because they're sort of worse to start with. But equally, the group that gets some gluten, they're in better shape. So maybe they can tolerate a bit of gluten. So you're not going to see, right? If there is a negative effect of gluten, you're less likely to see it in that group because they're, you know, already healthier. So like, there's a few things that, but at least they show us the individual data, which we like. We're big fans of that. So
yeah. So let's jump. So everybody's got it. Like everybody. So everybody. There's no control. Like the control group here is still on diet. Like this is not the control group is just not eating. They're all low FODMAP. It's just one group's getting gluten. The other group's not. And so this is the. I mean, we're seeing. First of all, like we talked about, like a 40-point increase. I can go down to the main table. I think we're seeing like. As far as that's why I talked about the placebo and like what's happened. There we go. Yeah. Total IBS scores. We're seeing that. Wow. The placebo group, which is just a low, we'll just call that a low FODMAP, just low FODMAP and then low FODMAP plus gluten. So low FODMAP group in this study went from, they dropped 150 points or 49% on this overall IBSSS. Like that is dramatic. and almost like across the board, stool frequency and consistency didn't significantly change. I guess they did from baseline 0.01. That one's, they're almost all, that one's not significant. Interesting. And then quality of life also increased for both groups significantly by a lot. So both of these groups, I think that's the mean average, both of these groups on this low FODMAP diet looks, I mean, semi-miraculous. Would you agree?
I mean, yeah. And you can see it also, like, you look at the placebo group, right? So low FODMAP, no gluten. And you look at some of the graphs, like quality of life and some of those, like
everybody improved. Let's look at some of this stuff. Like this is the overall score here. This is bananas. Everyone going down, not a little bit, like everyone. I want to see data. This is wild. And then placebo, every one of these placebos, everyone is going down. This is the first one we see at abdominal pain, I think that is. And then quality of life, everybody going up. And then the intervention, you kind of have that thing where some people go down. So the intervention, remember, is low FODMAP plus gluten. But I think that this is the main finding right here. Everybody in the control group got better on this low FODMAP diet. Obviously, the authors are very pro low FODMAP. And then I think this is the most interesting thing that we're going to talk about, is that five of 23 in this gluten group got worse, but the rest got better. And that was kind of your main takeaway from this, right, Tommy?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, big improvements overall, both groups. But, you know, from this paper and, you know, some other things that pop up in the literature, it seems like there's like a subset of people where, you know, they don't have celiac disease, but gluten is still a problem. And you can kind of see that from some of these graphs. Yeah, like 4 to 5 individuals, low FODMAP, but got gluten, and things got a bit worse. So there's like this subset of individuals where that does seem to be the case.
Yeah, and so I think this is where you kind of highlighted, and we'll link it below. There's this ideology that, so I do think that NCGS is a thing. I think that it is a thing. I think that it's a subpopulation of people with IBS, and so I want to come back to pragmatically, how do we? Because I think we get into a problem here where NCGS doesn't exist. Obviously, it's just FODMAPs. I think both of these, like one paper, you could take that away. But I think that's tenuous to do that. You could abstract read and take that away. I don't think you can take that away with the second paper. Would you agree?
No.
Okay. And so now say you're the person like me who's been gluten-free for 10 years. You've gotten a lot of symptom relief from this kind of ideology. I've even asked my wife to gluten me, without me knowing. I've literally told her throw flour and stuff without me knowing, and let's see if it affects my GI tract. I don't think that I don't necessarily know if it will or not. But let me kind of explain my thought process there. So I got transglutaminase tested when I was eating gluten free, and I could have been eating some gluten I didn't know, which is quite common. But I was negative. So I tried to do the celiac testing after the fact, and that doesn't work very well. So now you're in this weird place where you're like, do I want to go eat gluten for 6 weeks just to test if I have celiac disease? And I think most people, if you've had a lot of GI symptomology, you're going to say no to that. And so the next thing I think you can do is check your HLA DQ2 and DQ8. I have one of each of those. So if you didn't have those, you would have less, you would be very, it'd be quite unlikely that you'd have actual celiac disease, but you still could have NCGS if you're looking at the chart from this update from Cardenna and Torres in 2021. And so then you're kind of in this, then you're in this nebulous land of okay, what do I do? And I think that's where if you're just gluten-free and you still have symptomatologies and you haven't tried to lower your FODMAP content, I think you lower your FODMAP content. But if you're already doing both and you have symptom relief, here's my take. You may be able to be less extreme with it. That's currently my approach, is like, okay, I'm probably getting hit with gluten all the time because no one else in my immediate family is gluten-free. So I'm probably getting hit with it, and I don't have GI symptomatology right now. So I'm willing to make the bet that I don't have celiac disease, and I might have some type of NCGS at a low level or something like that, but I'm not going to worry about it. That's the first time I've articulated that. How do you feel about that, Tom?
Yeah, I think that's fine. There's two parts of it, right? One is that, you know, a whole bunch of people. So there's an interesting fact in one of the papers where they're like, I think nearly 50% of people in the US think that if something's gluten-free, it's automatically healthier, right? We know that's not true, right? Gluten-free cookies are still cookies, right?
They're probably more unhealthy. Like they're probably more dense. They probably have less nutrients. Like in general, I would say gluten-free baked goods are probably less healthy. So there's a lot of debunking that probably, like in the beginning, like I remember when my dad went gluten-free, like there was no gluten-free options. Like you ate, like my mom was making cashew bread, which was probably 10,000 calories. And he was eating everything, like he had to figure it out, right? And so that was a monumental change to his diet. But now you can just literally take your diet and just inject gluten-free into it. And I think when you do that, you inevitably lower your FODMAP consumption, probably. You didn't just go gluten-free, you also probably lowered your FODMAP. So you didn't just do the thing, you did multiple things.
So that's one part, right? I think probably the vast majority of people tolerate gluten just fine. And so like making the assumption that gluten-free processed foods, they still have the same health related caveats that most processed foods do, right? So like, don't assume that gluten-free is better. However, the other side of that is that, you know, you can eat a lot of great food and not eat gluten and have a very nutritious, nutrient dense, health promoting, health supporting diet. There's nothing essential about gluten in the diet. And so if you can do that and you feel good, I think that's great. Where there's like the gray area is if you become so worried about exposure to gluten that it starts to make your life harder, either more restricted or it's hard to go out to eat because you're so concerned about being exposed to gluten. And so that's where I think a formal diagnostic process can be helpful. The formal way to diagnose NCGS is with a double blind placebo-controlled gluten trial. And there are people that do that. And that can be certainly worthwhile. And because if you can get peace of mind, right, you don't have to actively go out and start eating all the bread, but if you're just not worried because it's not an issue, I think that can be beneficial. And then there's some stuff, which I think is also interesting. There are some papers looking at zonulin, circulating zonulin. So zonulin is a tight junction protein in the gut epithelium. And in people with like formally diagnosed NCGS versus just people with IBS, those with NCGS have higher circulating zonulin, which is hypothesized to mean that they have a less structurally sound gut lining, and then that zonulin protein is being released into the blood where you can measure it. So I don't think that's not formally diagnostic yet, but you know, that stuff is kind of on the way. So there's like some physical marker that you can measure in the blood of this process going on. So
I'm going to interject there, Tommy, just because I think this is important, because you'll see like the PubMed warriors here to be like, NCGS isn't a thing. Like everyone can eat gluten. Like only celiac disease is a thing, but NCGS does give you a higher, in general, very likely does give you a higher risk of autoimmunity. So you have this clustering of potentially increased permeability, increased zonulin, and there's maybe like it's a lot smaller population than we think, but a lot of things add up here. And now could you, like, now you're talking about thyroid autoimmunity, gut slowing down, constipation, all of that, potentially, you know, fiber things in the small intestine, eating things for longer, all that stuff comes along for the ride. But I do think that if we're thinking about the trajectory towards this being a thing, and then what are the risks for a certain number of the population, like gluten is a viable risk, I think. Now, and then would you agree with that?
Yeah. And we see from, so I think, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's close to a majority of American adults could be diagnosed with IBS, depending on, like, so IBS should be symptoms more than 3 months in a 6 month period. But
yeah, you'll see. Yeah. Like, what is the percentage of people with IBS?
It's a significant proportion.
You'll see it vary from like 3 to 5% to 20 to 30%. It's wild. Yeah. Like, depending on the citations that people pull.
But so say, you know, 20 to 30, up to 20 to 30% of people have IBS, and some like fraction of that, maybe it's only 10% of that. So, right, you're talking 1, 2, 3% of people max, probably. You know, within there, they have IBS where gluten is one of the contributors. And they're, you know, the people who formulated the Salerno criteria for the diagnosis of NCGS, they've written some update papers where they talk about there's this group where, yes, in general, IBS is more susceptible to FODMAPs, but there is a group where, you know, gluten is either the main or one of the contributors. And, you know, that may be 10% or something of that group, something like that. But it's a non-zero proportion of the population. So some small group of people who have IBS, gluten may be one of the main contributors. So I think it's worth reiterating that, yes, for the vast majority of people, it's not a problem, but there is going to be some non-zero, we don't know the exact percentage, but proportion of the population where it may be an issue.
Yep. I think kind of talking about like, okay, what is the likelihood of that? You got like celiac isn't zero. It's 0.7 to 1.4% of the population is like, that's a lot of people. Like that's a lot of people. And then even if you go NCGS on the low side of that, it goes for anywhere from like 0.6% all the way up to like 14%, depending on the diagnostic criteria. So even if you shoot like 3 to 4%, you're now talking potentially 4 to 5% of the population have an issue with this protein, which to me is that's 1 in 20 people are going to have a problem with this. So like, that's not zero. It's even hard to have a nuanced conversation about this, because I think if you have digestive symptomatology, you don't really care what the internet says. Like, you just want it to go away. And yeah. I think it's like, from a dietary side, I think you remove dairy, because lactose can do a number if you're lactose intolerant. Like, the amount of gas that lactose can create is really mind blowing. If you do have a problem digesting lactose. And then you probably get rid of gluten, and you reduce your FODMAP consumption significantly, and you see if that, like, maybe you would, like, so I'm trying to think of like how I would do this right now if I was just naive, if I was just in this, because I think that's a beautiful place to be. You just got GI symptoms and you haven't done anything yet. Maybe you don't know any of these words. I get tested for celiac disease right away, because I'd want to know, because celiac disease, like, if you're really, really trying to limit your exposure to gluten, it's meticulous. Like, we're talking like thumbnail type. And this is debated. Again, not everyone gets better with a gluten-free diet. If you have celiac disease, we're trying to figure out different ways to do this so that people don't have to be as, but if you're legit celiac disease, like, you can't use a toaster that has gluten. You can't use a fryer that has gluten. Like, you need new gloves. Like, it is strict. If you really want to be gluten-free. And the majority of people who claim to be gluten-free and have celiac disease are likely not. They are likely encountering smaller portions of gluten continuously. So if you have celiac disease, then you can know that. And then the next thing that you do is you do this Salerno criteria. Then you test the diets. If you get relief from the diet, so you do the, correct me if I'm wrong, you would do the low FOD. I would do like a low dairy, like a no dairy probably for a little while. Try to avoid gluten and lower FODMAP. And if you get relief, now you're in this double blind placebo controlled challenge land, and you're in a now you're in a really tough place. If we're just being honest and transparent, you're in a really tough place. You feel better, and a lot of people just want to stay there. They're like, okay, I feel better. What's it worth to me to add these other foods? Like, I don't care. Like, and I resonate with that. Like, I'm not going to be like, no, you have to eat an apple. Over time, maybe we can kill some of that fear. And that's taken me 10 years, but shit in your pants sucks, man. And so I think if we don't have some level of like perspective taking and some level of empathy for that, we can not be very helpful, in my opinion. And it's so I think of like, okay, someone's found relief with these things. How can we get back to a place of somewhat more normalcy where it doesn't take up so much bandwidth in their brain?
Yeah, I think that's if you can get the person feeling better and right, the diet isn't significantly impinging on their lifestyle beyond the amount that it needs to, right? That's the kind of sweet spot. So it's going to depend, right? The pain threshold is going to depend from person to person. But yeah, that's where you're going to have to navigate.
And I will say, like, being a gluten-free psychopath, I've been a gluten-free psychopath versus like being gluten-free, but not really worrying about it are vastly different things. Like I go to a restaurant, I just order something without gluten. No one even knows that I have to, like, I'll just order tacos with corn tortillas. Like, no one even has to worry about it. Now you're gluten-free. Like, if you go out to eat, you have to like militantly ask them what kind of gloves are they using? Like, so the amount, like, being casually gluten-free is even like pretty strict about it. Like, not knowingly eating gluten. Like, there's casually gluten-free and then there's like legit. So for me personally, that's been like monumentally different, like not having to be super worried about it, as compared to like being like very militant and like very, very worried. And you could make the argument like maybe that worry could have been causing some things as well. And then the next thing that we've talked about a ton is like low FODMAP. If you think about health wise in the GI tract, you're probably going to get some microbiome changes. Maybe it's not the best thing long-term. Bifidobacter seems to go down. So you do probably, the way I see it is like everybody's kind of got to find their happy place with it, right? You got to find your happy place with FODMAPs. You got to find your happy place with gluten. And that's a lot harder than having like this hard and fast rule. Like, this is the line. And that's just hard, because we all got to eat. How does that sit with you, Tommy?
Yeah, I think that's all right. I mean, I'm in a place in like gut microbiota research where, man, I just don't even know what a healthy gut microbiota looks like, right? So do we need fiber to have a healthy gut? My guess is no. We just don't have good populations to study to really understand that. But we know some of the biochemistry that says actually it shouldn't really be an issue. So people going around saying you have to eat X for a healthy gut microbiome, I don't think that's true. But you know, we don't really know.
You're in a place of don't know there.
Yeah, it's a I don't know rather than I think this is the case, right? So
let me clarify that so you don't get absolutely skewered. So I think this is an important point, because if you look at meta-analysis of observational trials in just the general population, food frequency questionnaires, you'll generally see a threshold of 25 to 30. So that's the amount of fiber where you seem to get the benefit from an all-cause mortality, everything. But with that comes a lot, like, that's higher diet quality. So it's hard to like take out those confounders there. Fruits and vegetables, generally gonna be 5 to 7 servings, seems to be where your break point is. But all of those are observational findings you're going to naturally pick out all the things that come along with that in observational research, probably higher SES, more physical activity, all that healthy user bias. And so I think Tommy's point here is like, and this is not someone who's saying this, who hasn't, like, y'all have done the research.
Yeah. So like, before anybody skewers me, like, read the paper that's going to be at the bottom of this, which I wrote, read that first. And then, you know, if you have critique of that, happy to chat about it. Yeah, because this is something that, you know, we've taken some time to look at, and all the caveats that, and at a population, right, in an average population, more fruits and vegetables, more fiber, better health outcomes, 100%. That doesn't mean that those things are necessary, 100% required. That's what I'm saying.
And I think that is a
two
really,
very different
really,
ways of approaching it.
I think that is a really, really, really big deal, because some people have found dramatic, dramatic changes in their overall health and quality of life from using a lower residue approach. And a lot of people are like, okay, we got to get you back to 5 to 7 fruits and servings of fruits and vegetables. And they might not want to do that. So how can you potentially get them a nutritionally adequate diet? And like, you could try, like, I think it's worth it to try. Like, obviously, like, I'm in the camp of like, okay, this is low FODMAP. This is what we do 4 to 8 weeks. I'm actually going to try to use a low FODMAP approach without ever using the word FODMAP. Cause I think I think using the word FODMAP might overpower the diet, the actual changes from the diet. Like, that's my personal approach right now. I think just using the words could overpower what you're taking away. Cause then you give people, especially with like, you start saying like low FODMAP is the best diet for IBS, we're going to put you on a low FODMAP diet and it's going to work. You start using that narrative, I think you're going to see amazing results. You could argue like, let's use that narrative. But I think the backside of it is like, now you have a fear-based narrative. And so you could make either argument. I just don't like fear-based narratives. And you're going to get that on the backside.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that I think is really beneficial and actually benefit, like, has benefited me, it just kind of like a bit of trial and error, not really thinking about it, but it's kind of like thinking back about things, and it kind of fits in with some of the specific carbohydrate diet approach. This is another approach to inflammatory, like, it's another elimination diet for inflammatory bowel disease with some trial evidence to support it. It's basically, there's a big difference, right? You can have the same vegetable, there's a big difference in terms of how you handle it, whether it's cooked or raw. Mm-hmm. And so in the specific carbohydrate diet, generally things will be cooked within an inch of their life to begin with. It's like you take a carrot and you cook that carrot hard. But, you know, if you retain the juices, right, you do it in a stew or a soup or something, right, all the nutrients will remain other than maybe the vitamin C, and some of the fibers will break down. Right. And if I eat a whole bunch of salad, just like a big fat salad, it doesn't really sit with me that well, but I can eat just like endless cooked vegetables, no problem whatsoever. And you know, there aren't that many populations around the world that just eat a whole bunch of raw weeds all the time, to be honest. So I'm like, there's it could be the same thing, then the way you prepare it could make a big difference.
I mean naturalistic fallacy, people are gonna be all over Tommy here. But I think what he talked about right there is this idea of cooking and processing, and every culture cooks and processes their food to some degree. It's the thing that probably allowed us to take over the world more than anything else, is like this cultural understanding of how to like basically make poisonous things edible. So where I go to here is like, yes. Yeah. I think that's a great point. Is like, can you just cook all your vegetables? Not even think about like, that's even less of an intervention than any type of restriction. Yeah. But where I wanted to take this was something even weirder, was sourdough bread. There's now multiple RCTs in NCGS and I'm not sure if they're all in NCGS, where sourdough bread in certain cultures does not seem to be a problem. So that's like one of the first things that I might go ahead and go out on a limb and go have me some sourdough bread. That sounds fantastic.
I think they've done it in NCGS and in IBS. And so, right, we know that certain species of lactobacillus break down gluten. And actually that's thought to be one of the reasons why people tolerate gluten in different amounts is the colonies of lactobacillus they have in their gut that actually just break down the gluten. It's not a big deal. But obviously, you know, lactobacillus in sourdough, that's what it's doing. It's breaking down some of those excess gluten proteins. And so sourdough is a nice intervention because there's good evidence for it, like you say.
Cool. So I kind of cut you off there. You were talking about you're kind of, we've talked about this, like clinical, like, okay, if you have GI symptomatology, you're worried about celiac disease, you've never done anything before, go get tested by a GI doctor who knows what they're doing, because you have gluten in your system. That's a good place to be. And if you don't have celiac disease and you have digestive symptoms, I think you do the things, like you try to do something about it. You can do it any way. You could do it any way that you want. Like you could try some type of very, very low residue approach, right? Mm-hmm. And if that gives you relief, then you can try reintroductions. But the key and the thing that I don't think we really articulate very well is like the reintroductions for someone who's had a ton of relief. Like you've gone from really, really bad GI symptomatology and now you feel great. That's a tough place to be because
and it takes a long time, right? Right. If you're doing it properly, you have one thing, you have a small amount of it, you have it for one meal.
No one does. Everybody just eats pizza.
Yeah. So if you do reintroductions properly, it's a pain in the butt because you have to do them one by one. Each one, you're probably going to take more than a week to do it. So start with the things that you'd really like to be able to eat. And then, you know, but you have
to isolate it. It might be a dose issue too. Like it might be, it might not. And it might, like Tommy said, this is so complex and that it might not even be, it might be a cooked dose issue, cooked versus raw. And I would definitely try cooked first. I eat the vast majority. I mean, I eat some carrots raw, some cucumbers, but the vast majority of our vegetables, we do eat them cooked. I think it's going to be easier on your GI tract. But the narrative that really bothers me is like, you have to be able to eat these things. Otherwise you're not going to be healthy.
Oh yeah.
I think that's a very judgmental and dogmatic place to be. I think a better place to be is like, we want your diet to be as flexible for you, as flexible as we can for you so that you can be as least limited as possible. But I'm really, really happy that you found a place where your GI system feels better. Like, I think that's a much better conversation than like, hey, you got to be able to eat all these foods because they're healthy.
Yeah. Agreed.
Anything to add on any of that, Tommy? We've been yammering. I'm sure we're both actually going to get skewered for this one. So let's just let it be.
Yeah. No, have at it. Read the papers first. I don't think there's much to add there. Hopefully some of that was useful.
This is something that in the beginning, like I was a big champion of Fasano. I would have taken your Zonulin thing and I would like, cause you can go in the literature and you can make the case that gluten is causing some type of gut inflammation, something in everyone. You can have a very fear-based narrative about gluten. And 10 years ago, I had that narrative. If you would have asked me probably 10 years ago, I would have said everybody probably should avoid gluten. I probably would have worded it exactly like that. Everybody probably should avoid gluten. And now I'm much more understanding. I'm not saying that I'm right. But I've definitely changed my mind a ton. And I've changed my mind to the point that I was someone who at 19 years old was driving at 2 a.m. to go get Pepto-Bismol because my GI system was so bad. And I found amazing relief from doing this diet. And now I'm actually considering eating sourdough bread 15 years later. Like that's a huge
sourdough bread toast with a bunch of butter on it. That's not much better than that.
For people who've read, I have a total cholesterol of 139. So I can eat some butter. I'll be all right.
I do actually want to add something, like, because it's important that you mentioned. So like the Zonulin stuff, I think is super interesting. I was an early adopter of the paleo bandwagon. I was on all of that. And I now disagree with a huge amount of what I said previously, just like you do. When people go around saying, you know, gluten always affects Zonulin, increases gut permeability, right? Pretty much every time you eat a meal, your gut permeability increases. Every time you exercise, your gut permeability increases. Every time you get stressed in any way whatsoever, your gut permeability increases. It's part of a normal physiology. And there's like some interesting stuff about how, you know, our gut and body communicate. And that's partly how we do it. We're like, every time we eat, a whole bunch of stuff from the gut, lipopolysaccharides, other things, cross and we're sampling the environment which we're being exposed to, right? It's a normal part of human physiology. So like anytime anybody sells you fear based on gut permeability because of this thing, right, you better not go for a run because that's going to increase gut permeability. Right, you better not study for a test because that's going to increase gut permeability. So like, just there's a huge amount of important context, and yes, some of these things can cause disease processes. Celiac, absolutely a thing. Huge increase in gut permeability, right? Yes, NCGS is a thing, but don't be sold on don't do X because of gut permeability, because it happens all the time. It's part of normal physiology.
Yep, I think there's nothing wrong with going to a lower residue approach, and if that gets you relief, that's amazing. You combine a lower residue approach with an incessant fear of omega-6 oils and everything that comes along with that cluster of people, I think then you've been sold a lot of fear that I think is unnecessary. Like, you think vegetables are the devil and, you know, any type of industrial seed oil is going to immediately kill you. You're in a bad place. I that's not a place that I want to be. Like, but I can honor that person feels a lot better on a low residue approach. What's going to be the diet for them long term? How can I meet them where they are, have a genuine conversation, and just connect with them around shitting our pants together? and just really like, this is a shitty place to be. Let's I'm so glad that you feel better. I go to like this threat response with humans, right? It's like, I think of this, I always do this in exercise too, is like, I'm not going to like just absolutely mangle someone their first time in the gym, right? We're going to use like, we're going to I don't want to give them rhabdo, right? And so I think it's the same thing. It's like, you tread carefully, you like, okay, what feels like a threat to you? Because I think once you instigate that threat response, like psychogenically, you're probably going to get symptomatology. So I think they have to feel safe as they go on this path. So maybe a psychologist would be just as important as a nutritionist. And I don't think we have that research paper, but that might be interesting. Like CBT and FODMAPs versus CBT. So thanks, Tommy. I hope that was helpful for people. I hope we didn't, I don't really care. I at this point in my life, like, I don't really care. Like, if people who want to be mad on the internet are mad with me, because you just want to be mad. All the studies are below. We've talked about them. If you feel differently with the published literature, have a comment, talk to me. But otherwise, I don't really care.
Peace.